Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 16, delivered on March 22, 2012. The title of this lecture is Annuities and Perpetuities.
Today, annuities and perpetuities. The subject will also take us into a couple of other realms, including the capital asset pricing model, which I'll just show you. Here's how we do it. Here's the formula. It's a simple formula. Explain a little of the background of that. This culminates in a couple of quite useful methods that we have, for example, for pricing a share of stock. That's one thing that comes out of this lecture. Also, what we're doing here will be useful later on in the course when we get to the marginal cost of capital and all that. But for now, it's just mostly just an exercise, some formulas that you've seen before, as well as some new stuff. First things first, annuities. What I showed you on Tuesday was a level annuity. In other words, the same amount was happening at regular intervals. And that regularity of the intervals doesn't hurt us much. We do that all the time. Every year you get so much money from this project until the end of the project. The part that's not always accurate is the part about level. In other words, the same amount. Now, if we're talking about calculating loan payments, absolutely. No question about that. But in the reality of how projects proceed, generally speaking, and we usually do this as a timeline, some kind of a timeline, if I could draw one straight here. The truth of the matter is that at the beginning of a project, you're probably going to have money that's going to go out. Some amount. And we'll deal a lot with that at a later time going to net present values. But as a project proceeds through its life, it very well might not have the same amount of money happening. So for example, a project might bring in 10 grand the first year, maybe 10 grand the second year, and then it boosts to 20 grand, maybe 20 grand, and then it might settle back to 10 grand, and it's, we might have, at the end of the life of the project, 5 grand, and then you've got a salvage value as well. When the project ends, you might have a positive salvage value. Let's say in this case you've got a positive salvage value of, let's say, $8,000, along with the last year's cash flow from the project. No, it is an annuity, and it's regular in the sense that it is going along in regular time intervals. And if we were looking at present value, or even future value, this is an ordinary annuity because the cash flows are occurring at the end of each period. All of those are great, except that it is no longer a level annuity, so you can't use the level annuity formula, either the one that's mathematical or the one that's on your calculator. You can't do it that way because you don't have the same payment happening throughout the life of the project. There are two ways to do it. You can do it brute force. You can just take the present value of each lump sum, just bring them each back, just hammer them back, one after the other after the other. You can do it that way. Let's say your discount rate for this project is, I don't know, let's do 8%, okay? You can just do a lump sum present value for each one of these at 1 year, 10,000, 2 years, 10,000, 3 years, 20,000, 4 years, 20,000, 5 years, 10,000, 6 year, 13,000. You just add the salvage value to the last year. That's all you do. Don't ever be bluffed if I give you a salvage value. Just put it on the last year's cash flow, okay? Again, if I give you a salvage value then, just tack it on the last year's cash flow. That's all you ever do. Don't make it complicated. But again, I can just use brute force. I could do 10,000 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative first power plus 10,000 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative second power plus 20,000 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative third power plus 20,000. This is getting old real fast. Plus 0.08 to the negative fourth power plus 10,000 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative fifth power plus 13,000 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative sixth power. Just add up those numbers and there's your present value. Let me make sure you know, I'll give you a chance to write that down. Brute force, just each one as its own lump sum, telescope it back to the present. That's just straight present value attack. And honest to God, I do it that way myself more often than not. There's a fancier way to do it. And I'm going to show you the fancy way, but if you don't see it, don't sweat it. You can always go back this way. And like I said, I actually do it this brute force way myself more often than I probably should. I'm going to show you the finesse way to do these. The problem with the finesse way is that you can spend more time getting fancy than you would spend just beating the thing down one lump sum at a time back to the present. Let me draw the timeline again. This is year zero. One, year two, year three, year four, year five. Notice, by the way, I do these timelines. I like to do them because it gives me a visual look at what's happening. I'm going to write down the amounts here. 10K first year, 10K second year, 20K, 20K, and then it was 10K, and then it was 13K out there on year six. And again, if you don't see it this way, some people are really good at this. It's actually goes back to old set theory. You remember those Venn diagrams and all that kind of stuff? This is actually a variation on those old tricks from set theory. If I look carefully at this, I see that there is actually a level ordinary regular annuity in here. There is a $10,000 annuity all the way through. But in years three and four, there's also a topper on it. And then in year six, there's a topper on it of $3,000. Do you see that? Make sure you see that. There's actually a hidden annuity that's completely level in there. Well, I could actually, that means that what I could do is calculate the present value of the level annuity and then just add these little residual pieces on at the end as present values of a lump sum. I could do it that way. So I could pull out my calculator and say, all right, I got a level annuity sitting in here, a $10,000 one. So I go to my calculator, turn it on, and I say apps finance TVM solver time value of money solver. Now I want to make sure you can do this. It's a six-year annuity, so N is six. The percent is 8. The present value, I don't know, so I'm just going to leave that. Come back up to that. The payments are $10,000 each. There's no kicker at the end. Actually, I could put a kicker on the end. What would I put on the FV if I wanted to make it a little easier even? Not seven? My ass. Three. Wait. Yes, three. Because, see, there's that kicker at the end. It's a $10,000 payment at the end, but then there, which is part of the annuity, but then there's a kicker of $3,000 on top of that at the end. So I could put an FV of three in there and simplify it a little more. Do you see that? Let me make sure you see that. I can put a $3,000 on the FV because I've got a little kicker that came from that big punch of the salvage value. So on the FV, I could put a $3,000. And then I go up to the present value and I say, solve it. And I find out that this piece, including that little kicker there at the end, that has a present value of $48,019.31. Do that on your calculator. I want to make sure you can get that. Can you get that on your calculator? And I'm asking you to do it in case I made a mistake. What was it? N was 6 years. It's a 6-year $10,000 annuity with a sweetener on the hind end of it of $3,000. Yeah. PMT. That's what you're calculating. Oh, I'm sorry. No. $10,000. Just testing you. $10,000. Did you get $48,119? Okay, let me make sure you know why I got that. I basically, what I did was I teased out that there was that river of a regular $10,000 annuity. It just had some pops in it. Now, I'm not done, though, because I've still got a deal. See these two right here? See these two little mother, or these things right here? These things, I'm still going to have to pull their present value back. This one happened at year three, so I'm going to need to get its value, present value, 10,000 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative third. And then I had another one here, 10,000 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative fourth. Okay? So I've got to get those two little pups right there done. And I'll go back out into the regular calculator to take care of that. I'll do 10,000 times 1 plus 1.08 to the negative third. I'm going to just do them together. Plus 10,000 times 1.08, close the parentheses, to the negative fourth. And together, those two things come up with a present value of $15,288.62. Which I can now add to that original amount that I got from the level annuity, and I can come up with a final amount. That the entire annuity stream comes out to be $63,407.93. Okay? Now, again, I trust you can see that I'm going through an awful lot of gyrations, going five times around the barn to get to the outhouse doing it this way. But where it actually begins to have much more use is if you've got these really long streams with just a few turbulences in them, long streams of cash flow, it actually does get to be easier to tease out the underlying regular level annuity and then just deal separately with the turbulence that's on top of it. But really, it's in this one, it's kind of a mixed bag. It'd probably be almost as easy just to hammer it out, straight lump sums, like I did, like I wrote up here. But this number should come out to be the same as this number. And it's like I said, it's almost like a personal preference. On an exam or a quiz, I wouldn't give you some monster thing. This would probably be as bad as I'd do it. Maybe 6 years or something like that with some ups and downs in it. But what you would look for is the level stream that was underneath and then deal with the little pieces as a separate problem. Don't forget to do them, of course. But like I said, you know, there you are. It's whichever way is your preference on these. Some people can just see these level annuities really easily. Other people have a kind of a hard time seeing the hiding part. Yeah. Oh, then I'd put a negative on there. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. His question was, well, what would happen if I had, like, this thing hadn't had a very big salvage value, so this last number had been below 10,000. Could I have still done an annuity? I could have done it a couple of ways. One, I could have just done a five-year level and then just dealt with that mess there at the end. Or I could have done the 10,000 and then done a negative FV on the kicker. Glad you brought that up. Do you see what I'm saying there?
Yeah,
I mean, that's actually kind of a cool way. Because really, at the end of the life of a project, your last year is just going to be maybe a few scrap dollars coming out as the project dies. But then you're going to have that salvage value. But a lot of times, salvage value is pretty paltry. And so it might not be enough to construct the clean annuity across. But even if that had been like $8,000, I would have just put a $10,000 and then put an FV, a kicker at the end of negative $2,000 on it, something like that. I can do it that way, and that probably, especially if it were a long annuity, I'd probably do it that way. Before I go any further, I want to bring up one quick thing. See that 8% discount rate? There's a question that can come up. Where did you get 8%? I pulled it out of my ass. Before anyone gets a cell phone out and photographs that. That discount rate is hugely important. How much we are going to discount. The higher the discount rate, the lower the present value of any given amount of money in the future is going to be. Higher discount rate means that there's more likely to be a bad present value of the cash flow. But that 8% or whatever discount rate I use, honestly, I've seen companies that just pull them out of their butts. But there are ways to do it technically and ways that are theoretically sound, that are defensible. The most powerful of the methods that exists, even to this day, is the capital asset pricing model. Now, the story of this is that we knew in finance about the CAPM way back almost a half century. It's a way of finding a discount rate. It's actually a fairly simple formula, and it has all kinds of uses and all kinds of implications. But it's a simple formula for finding a discount rate. And I'm even going to write you the formula right here. The discount rate for any project K, and I'm going to write a case of P, for a project, for a stock, dividends, whatever, anything that you need a cash flow discount rate for, is going to be equal to the risk-free rate of return. And remember I told you in the earlier part of the course that usually we use a T-bill, a short-term T-bill, to proxy for the risk-free rate, plus this animal called beta. And beta will depend upon the project, the stock, whatever it is you're talking about a cash flow for, dividends, whatever, times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. And I'll explain all later. I'll explain it presently. But let me give you the background, just a little bit of the background, one more time, just briefly. We knew about this formula. It comes from very sound, basic financial theory. It's hard to punch through this. There have been these researchers and ambitious writers of papers in finance who've tried to offer supplemental or better formulas for finding discount rates. One of them is called APT, the arbitrage pricing theory. But really, CAPM survives. Interestingly enough, we were teaching management students CAPM for quite a few years before it was accepted by the government. You see, the government, back in the day, they regulated industries much more heavily than they do now. For example, utilities, they would say, utility, you can't charge whatever you want for the electricity you're providing. You must charge a price that gives you a reasonable rate of return on your investment, and that's all. You can't just charge whatever you want because you're a monopoly in this area. So the regulators would figure out a discount rate for the cash flows from revenues from utility companies charging customers. And then they would say, all right, this is the rate that you are going to be allowed to charge per kilowatt hour or whatever. But it always started with figuring out a fair or reasonable rate of return based on the risk of the utility company. This was very soon adopted as the way to find that rate, that discount rate for the cash flows from the utility bills. And they use, all right, this discount rate is the one we'll use, and that will give this company, make this company profitable to the extent that it should be if it were in a competitive industry. Interestingly enough, it was clear into the 1970s, utility companies were challenging CAPM, saying, oh, that's just some hocus-pocus theory. Here's what we think our fair rate of return should be. And, of course, it was always ridiculously higher than what CAPM said it should be. And like I said, it was only, I think it was pretty much into the 1980s before the courts in these challenges began to accept the CAPM as the way to find the rate of return, instead of the way the utility companies were saying, well, we think it should be this, this is what we feel it should be, this is what our numbers people say it should be. The regulators were saying, no, we use this CAPM. It's used in academic circles. It's being taught to all the students these days. This is how we do it. And the courts just said, we'll listen to utility companies. So a CAPM might have given a rate of return of 7.8% as being reasonable for the utility company. The utility companies would challenge it in court and say, we're coming up with a rate of return of 18.2% as being reasonable based upon the risk of our company. And like I said, for a long time, the courts would take the utility company's rate as being right, and they rejected this as being theoretical hocus pocus. Finally, that went away, and now there are some things that you would learn if I taught you a really advanced finance course, other ways that you can find a discount rate for cash flows. But honest to God, even in the real world, I would be using CAPM. It's that powerful. It is that useful. It's that easy. Now, let me explain to you what CAPM is all about. Again, whenever you're trying to find a risk discount rate for a project, like cash flows, whatever, this case of P, the first thing we're going to say is, look, every investment has to pay at least the risk-free rate, the real rate plus an expected inflation premium, because you can buy a government treasury bill that has no risk at all as a substitute for any investment whatsoever. So every investment on the planet would have to at least cover what you could get risk-free. That's the logic of that case of F at the beginning of the formula. Now we're going to look at something else. In parentheses here, I'm going to say, all right, if you bought a perfectly diversified market portfolio, you would have no diversifiable, non-systematic risk in it. Now, I'm going to take away the risk-free rate, and we would call case of M, the expected return to a perfect market portfolio, minus the risk-free rate, we would call that the expected market portfolio premium over risk-free. It's how much more reward you assume by investing in the market portfolio instead of in a risk-free instrument. So the long name of this is the expected market portfolio premium over the risk-free rate. So in other words, if I expected a perfectly diversified market portfolio to return me 12%, and I could buy a treasury bill, a short-term, perfectly safe T-bill for 2%, then the premium, the extra reward for taking risk would be 10%. Again, if I expect a perfectly diversified, wildly broad market portfolio that included everything in the economy in its proportion to the economy, I earn 12%. But if I can earn money risk-free for 2%, that must mean that I am expecting the reward for taking the risk of the market portfolio to be 10%. That's a pure risk premium. It's how much more I get for taking risk than not taking risk in my investment. But now we've got to put a scaling factor, because not every project is exactly as risky as investing in a market portfolio. That's where this little son of a dog, beta, and I write beta of the project, comes in. It's a scaling factor. To give you an idea, the beta of a T-bill would be zero. It has no risk. The beta of the market portfolio is exactly one. Those are the anchors of it. 100% of the risk is the market portfolio. 0% of the risk is the treasury bill. And everything we talk about, stocks, bonds, derivatives of all kinds, projects, they all can be measured in one way or another, for better or worse, with better or worse methods, on the beta scale. In fact, and this is where I'm going to try to boot this imbecile machine up here for a minute, I will show you, and the reason that sucked was because, oh, okay. I'm going to show you that if you look at any stock quotation service worth its salt, they're going to tell you the beta of the stock. That is a perfectly legitimate measure of the non-diversifiable risk of that stock relative to the market portfolio. Again, let me say that again, because I will ask that as an essay question on the next exam. Beta, oh damn, I better write that down. Beta is the measure of the non-diversifiable risk of a project or a stock relative to the market portfolio. So if I told you the beta was 0.5, I would be telling you that its non-diversifiable risk was half of holding the market portfolio. If I told you that the beta was 2, that stock's non-diversifiable risk is twice the market portfolio. Now, I caution you here on something that is mighty important. Why can't they just put Internet Explorer? Oh, that's right, IT people, get Firefox. No, I won't. Bite me. Okay. Give me a second here, for God's sake. Bear with me. Beta is the measure of the non-diversifiable risk. A measure of the non-diversifiable risk of an investment, a stock, whatever, relative to the market portfolio. Relative to the market portfolio. Okay, so we have this metric. Now, I want to caution you. This is not the risk of the stock. If I give you the beta of a stock, and I say the beta is 0.5, well, that would be a fairly low-risk stock. You could very well, if you bought that stock, you could very well get your clock cleaned and your ass kicked. Wait a minute, that thing was volatile as hell. Why? It had a beta of 0.5. What is all this price volatility? That's non-systematic risk. Beta is going to tell you what the risk is if you're not stupid. If you're stupid, the risk is going to be phenomenal, even on low beta stocks. Look at this. Here we go. Apple. Look at that beta. You see how that's almost the market portfolio? It's approximately 104% of the non-diversifiable volatility of the market portfolio. So, but I can't say buying Apple is the same as buying the market portfolio. No, it's not, because beta is telling you how much non-diversifiable risk is in there. If I put a bunch of stocks together, different stocks, all of them with betas around this one, I would construct a decent market portfolio. But if I buy Apple on its own, I am very likely to become very poor because there is a lot of price volatility in there that beta is not going to tell you about, because no one's going to reward you for being stupid unless you get into one of those movies like Jackass. Let me try another one. My ass. Microsoft, 1.05. Again, notice how close these big, big companies are to the market portfolio. That, in a way, is actually kind of scary, because essentially, these companies are so large that they're virtually markets themselves. Not surprising on those kinds of companies. Let me try something a little different here. I want to do Berkshire Hathaway. Well, that helped a lot. Why? I feel like I'm screwing. How did I get away from Yahoo Finance? I wanted finance. Let me try. Oh, I see. Okay. Let me try something like. Why do I keep going away from where I want to be? Yeah, that's right. I keep typing in the wrong place. This is way too much like work. Can't believe I'm actually searching something called Yahoo. Why can't you find the stupid ass server? I did? That's why I should not be allowed around computers. I keep beating them. Let me find something interesting here, just something that's interesting. Recent quotes, most active, Oracle. Let's look at Oracle. Here's one that's a little more risky. It's about 129% of the non-diversifiable risk of the market portfolio. Again, you can't just buy this stock and say, I am bearing a higher risk and therefore an expected higher return. No, you're not. You would have to have this in a diversified portfolio. Let me see what else I can do here. SAP is another in the same industry. 1.35. SAP is basically in the same business as Oracle. There's still big companies, big, huge, enormous companies. Interesting stuff to talk about. Intuit. Look at this one. Low beta, lower risk company. However, again, on its own, this could be a really wicked price volatility type of deal. You wouldn't want to say, okay, I want about half of the risk of holding the market portfolio, so I'll buy Intuit. It's not going to work that way because all that beta is telling you is how much risk there would be in a broad-based portfolio that included Intuit. I wanted to find something interesting here. Let me do something like this. I want to find a gold stock, and I can't think of any off the top of my head because I stay away from the gold bugs. They're such creepy-ass people. Let me do it this way. Let me go back to where I was. I'm going to show you a couple of other quick things here. Let's go with some Fortune 500s. Pull a couple out. I know Ace Hardware. I wanted to find Ace Hardware, something like that. But well, that was a big mistake. I stepped into Hoover's, and now I'm going to have to put up with their stupid marketing. Full list. Money. At CNN. Okay, good. Okay, here we go. Let me get down here to something. Oh, let's look at Kroger. That's not what I wanted. Okay, I'm going to look at Kroger, Home Depot. Okay, let's do Kroger, Home Depot, and IBM. And maybe we'll step over down here to something low like Google. Kroger, IBM, Home Depot. Okay. Call it high or low beta. Very good. This is almost a T-bill. Why? It's food. Big food company. All over the place. Let's try something else. Let's try IBM. High or low? Was there some reason that sucked when I did that? It's sort of like coitus interruptus or something. Well, that's a little lower than I thought it'd be, 0.6. Let's try Home Depot. Okay, there it is, home. There it is. Ooh, higher. A little higher, Home Depot is. A little bit riskier. Why? Why? Talk. And what? Good. Oh, it's volatile. It's challenged. Actually, housing is the only one that's really still a little scary in the recovery right now. And there's another one, too. Fierce competitors. Home Depot's got Menards regionally, it's got Lowe's, and it's got other places too. It's more in a more competitive framework. That was not what I wanted at all. Okay. Let me look for something here. I wanted to find the fast companies. No, that wasn't what I wanted there at all. Okay. But you get the idea. Now, I'm going to tell you an interesting thing here. Betas between 0 and 1. Beta between 0 and 1 has less non-diversifiable risk than the market portfolio. A beta of 1 would say it's got 100% of the risk of the market portfolio, non-diversifiable risk. Moving it a little bit forward from there, you can get above 1. You can get betas that are up there 2, 2.5. I've seen betas very high. Here's the weird ones. Betas that are slightly negative. There are companies out there that have negative betas. Usually they're not massively negative. Negative 0.35, I've seen a negative 0.7, something like that. A negative beta is what we call, a one term for it is a contrarian's stock. It's essentially, it's counter to the market. These are the kind of stocks that you buy if you're a bear. And I mean that in the investments term. There's a term bear that has nothing to do with that. But one place where you'll see negative betas is in gold mining stocks. Gold mining stocks historically have had negative betas. As a matter of fact, there are mutual funds that exclusively invest in negative beta securities. They are contrarian. They're called contrarian funds. If you think that whenever, if you are the kind of person who says that when the market is going up, it will go down because everyone's stupid except for me, then you are a contrarian. You would go for negative betas. Low betas and negative betas, so that you actually bucked against the tide of a market on average. But again, you would want to have a diversified portfolio. And like I said, there are mutual funds that actually they specialize in negative betas. And in fact, there are these mutual funds within very reputable groups of funds. You'll get mutual funds, they post their beta, beta 0.8, beta 1.3. Beta 1.9, beta negative 0.15. If you are into that kind of thing, you move your funds into those contrarian funds. For example, if you were to believe, and I'm not giving you investment advice, but if you were to believe that we are on a roll upward with the stock market, but you thought that you had a good sense that the market is still going to go up for a while, but then it's going to turn around and get really ugly, you might want to try to move from a positive beta mutual fund to a negative beta mutual fund for a while, so that you essentially captured the negative, the contrarian sentiment that was building in the market. So that when the stocks finally did tank, you made money when the market was not making money. You'd have to believe that you foresaw something that the whole market didn't see, or most of the market didn't see. And again, gold mining stocks are one of the prospective places. I was looking for some gold mining stocks there. I can't remember any off the top of my head right now. But that's a place where you can get negative betas. But one way or the other, it's actually worth your while to look through stocks, because essentially what this does is it tells you something about the risk profile of the company. Like, for example, if I wanted to Yeah, there we go. The Limited. That's got a beta above one. You say, all right, I like the company. I'm not going to just buy this stock, but I like the company, and I'm constructing a portfolio that I'd like to be a little riskier than the market portfolio. I'd like to take the risk and expect a return a little above the market portfolio. Then this is the one I'd get. Now, let me take this off the board here just for a second. I'm going to show you something here. Bear with me. Let's look at it realistically. I'm going to just, these numbers, I actually, to a, one of them, I'm going to pull out of my butt a little bit. I've seen some different surveys of major investment analysts. Right now, if I remember right, I'm thinking that I saw an expected return to the market portfolio of about 11.9%. Now, the risk-free rate right now is some stupidly low 0.25%, something like that, some ludicrously low rate. The Fed's keeping the T-bill rate stupidly low. Now, I know that the beta of Limited is 1.22. So I can say the expected return to limit holding Limited stock, the if it were in a well-diversified portfolio of stocks of the same beta or around it, would be the risk-free rate, and you can just use the percentages. For the CAPM, this is the only place you can do it. You can just use the percentages. The risk-free rate plus the beta of Limited times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Now, if I work that out, I'll get, first of all, let me make a quick side note here. The premium, the market premium over risk-free right now, and that has nothing to do with Limited or anything, that's just the premium to the holding the market portfolio, is about 11.65%. That's how much reward you get for holding the market portfolio instead of risk-free. Now, if I scale that by beta for this stock, I find that the extra reward above risk-free for holding Limited is about 14.21%. That's the reward above risk-free for holding Limited in a diversified portfolio. Now, I have to add back in the risk-free because everyone gets at least that. The market's going to give that. So I can say right now that a diversified portfolio mimicking limited at 1.22 beta, I expect a return of 14.24% approximately. I expect that. That's not what I will get probably, but that's my expectation of what I will get. You are expecting that someday you're going to make a lot of money and you're going to be very comfortable in your life and you're going to live to an old age. The truth of the matter is tomorrow you could die. I'm not saying you will, but I'd kind of lock my doors tonight. You know, I saw something in a dream last night. I think it was you, except I couldn't see because they were using a spatula to get you off the floor. It's an expectation, okay? Always know that when I say things like this, there's no guarantee. But this is where the center of our volatility is, 14.238%. That's how powerful this beta is. And you can see that when I did that discount rate calculation up there, what I would have been doing when I did that first kind of silly little exercise, showing you different ways to get the present value of an unlevel annuity, I put that 8% up there. We get these all the time in business. We have to analyze projects. We give our best estimates of the expected future cash flows, and we look at the present value of those against the cost of the project. We need a discount rate. How do we get the discount rate for a project? We use CAPM. How do we get the beta for a project? I'm talking about stocks here. Usually what we do is we say, all right, we got a project. We look for companies that do just that kind of thing, and we look at their betas. Okay, this project involves opening a new line of small burger joints. Drive-throughs. Okay, let's look at a bunch of companies that do that. Let's look at the average of their betas. That'll give us the beta that we need to do the CAPM so that we can get this discount rate for our project. In other words, what we do is we look at comp betas. Comp betas. That's how we do it a lot of times. We'll say, all right, we got a project. We're a big, big company, a lot of different projects. This project has to do with this kind of business. Okay, we go out there and we look for stocks that do that business. We look at sort of like an average of their betas. Oh, all the betas seem to be around 1.7. Okay, we're going to use 1.7 for our CAPM. Then we just pump the CAPM out, get ourselves a K/P, a project discount rate, and then that's what we use to run through our TI-83s or our Excels. That's how we do it in this business. I'm going to go on to perpetuities on Tuesday. That's all I have for you. Thank you.